It's Central Time. I'm Keely Boltina in for Rob Ferret, and you're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, rising prices plus stagnant wages have contributed to a housing crisis in La Crosse. We take a look at how the pandemic intensified the problem with a local reporter. First, it's that wonderful time of year when tomatoes are plentiful, whether you're growing them yourself or you're picking them up at a local farm stand or a store. So we thought it was a great time to check in with Deb Millian about how to use our tomatoes fresh and how to preserve them to enjoy them year-round. Deb is an online writer, recipe developer, homemaker, and traveler. On her website, wisconsinhomemaker.com, she shares her favorite family-friendly recipes along with helpful seasonal tips for your home and garden. She's also a Wisconsinite who loves to travel throughout the state to find and try new products and produce made right here in Wisconsin. Deb, nice to have you back on Central Time.
Thanks. Thank you for having me.
Before we get into specific ideas for using tomatoes, how do you know when they're ripe and really ready to eat?
Well, it depends upon what you're using them for. For example, if you're going to be using green tomatoes for a recipe, then you don't need to worry. You catch them when they're just green. But when you're looking for real ripe tomatoes, you want them to be firm, not to have any blemishes on them or cuts. Although, like if you're getting, if you're growing or purchasing heirloom tomatoes, sometimes those deformities that are on the tomato actually add and enhance its nature, but it really doesn't hurt it at all or bother the taste. So if I were going to the grocery store, I would be looking for, you know, bright red tomatoes if I'm looking for a beefsteak or Roma, and nice, shiny, firm flesh. And that's basically how you kind of look for it. If it's really squishy, I would kind of, you know, steer clear of those. If you're growing them in your garden, however, and they haven't really gone, you know, moldy, for example, they would be absolutely perfect for sauces and for juices. Mm-hmm. So it just depends, again, on what you're planning on using them for.
What about that in between, say, for instance, you have, you know, tomatoes that are kind of in that orangey green range, but you're worried about critters in your backyard getting to them before you can. What do we do with those? Do we trust the process, or do we pick them and bring them in?
You can actually bring them in if you want to. Usually what I'd like to do is to lay them out close to either a window and let them redden naturally. Or you can put them in like a paper bag and let them do that as well. The one thing you do not want to do with tomatoes is put them in the refrigerator, because that'll make them become very mealy and they won't taste as fresh as it would be if you just let them finish ripening on your counter. So like if you're coming to the end of the season, and we're kind of in the middle to the end of it, and we've got a little bit of time before the first frost. So what I would suggest is just, you know, use what you can. And then if you do have any extra that you want to, you know, start canning or whatever, you know, start them, you know, ripening and kind of spread it out over time. Because if anyone's garden's like mine, at times, you know, you have this, you know, it's like feast or famine. And so you try to use them up as quickly as possible when they're at their prime.
Right. They're not ready when you want them to be. And then everything's ready at the same time and you just can't get through them. Deb Millian is an online writer, recipe developer, homemaker, and traveler. And we're getting tips on what to do with all of those tomatoes that signal a turning point in the summer. And you're part of this conversation. Give us a call at 800-642-1234. Tell us about your favorite way to use tomatoes or how you have a strategy for handling that bounty when they all become ripe all at the same time. That number again is 800-642-1234. Deb, you shared a few recipes with us. You can find them. People can find them over at WPR.org/Food Friday. Let's start with a simple no-cook recipe, the classic caprese salad. Walk us through that.
Okay. This is actually one of my favorite summertime salads because it really takes minimal ingredients. So you can use anything from cherry tomatoes to beefsteak, Romas, whatever you have on hand. And you'll slice them and kind of layer them with like buffalo mozzarella. or you can even use mozzarella balls. And then I like to tear up basil on top of it, and then just sprinkle it lightly with some extra virgin olive oil or even a little bit of balsamic vinegar, and then just salt and pepper to taste. You can even add a little bit of red wine vinegar if you have that, or even white distilled vinegar, and then have at it. You can eat it. You can eat it as a salad. You can make it as a meal. We've also, in our family, we've put it on toasted bread and layered it up with fresh sliced salami and made it into a great summertime meal that's even perfect for picnics. It's really amazing.
Well, and it's got such a bright and fresh taste to everything. Like, it just feels right. Like you just picked it, whether, you know, you've had that tomato for a couple of days or not. It just feels so refreshing, I guess.
Mm-hmm. It is. And what I like to do is just let everything, you know, kind of marinate for, 10, 15 minutes before I serve it. And it's ready to go anytime.
You've mentioned that the balsamic vinegar is optional, which I wouldn't have considered. Why do you use it sometimes and maybe not others?
The thing about balsamic vinegar is, you know, a lot of people think you just pour it on like salad dressing, but balsamic vinegar in for the Italians actually is just more like a really light dressing. And when you drizzle just a little bit on over everything, just a really light dusting of it, it really adds another depth of flavor to it. And if you wanted to go, you know, like say you want to go more acidic type of thing, then I would go to the red wine vinegar, which is not listed on the recipe, but I've done that as well, where you kind of create more of a salad-y type of caprese. But the one thing I wanted to mention too is this also is really great if you make skewers. So if you're doing like an appetizer, going to a pool party, or you just want to do something fun, you can, you know, get the round buffalo balls and the cherry tomatoes, and then put a little piece of basil in between and make really delicious skewers. So they go very well for appetizers as well.
Everything is more fun when you're eating it off of a stick.
I know.
It just skewer the tomato and the mozzarella and just go for it. Uh-huh. And Mary on Facebook mentioned that tomato, onion, greens, and hummus on toast is Mary's go-to lunch this summer. That sounds delicious.
It does. You can't go wrong with hummus because hummus is just loaded with protein and lots of flavor. So, yeah, I love it.
And the element of crunch, because sometimes, you know, tomatoes don't always have the most exciting texture. So if you bring in the hummus and the onion and the toast, then you've, you've made it a little more interesting maybe.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Because basically what it is like, say, for example, this caprese salad, it's just a start. And from there, you can build on it. Like this salad can even be expanded to be like an antipasto salad where you can make it like a panzella type of salad, an Italian salad where you add like dried bread and then you add your dressing on top of that, along with, you know, diced salami and pepperoncinis and all the and different olives and you just mix it up and you have a summer salad. So this is why I think the Italians really like the salad, and I love it too, because it's just a springboard for many different tastes and expressions of eating. Mm-hmm.
Gabe on Facebook agrees. Gabe says basil, balsamic, and mozz 100%. So I think we have some people in agreement with you there, Deb. It's Food Friday, and we're talking tomatoes with Deb Melian. She's an online writer. She develops recipes. She travels across the state. She's got a website, WisconsinHomemaker.com, where we can find favorite family recipes, along with helpful seasonal tips for our home and garden. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite variety of tomato that you grow or that you buy? Maybe you enjoy them fresh, or your real purpose is to preserve them, enjoy them in the colder months. Give us a call now at 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Food Friday continues here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. Thanks for being with us on Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina. We are continuing our Food Friday conversation about tomatoes with Deb Melian. She's an online writer and a recipe developer. And we also have recipes that we're talking with her today posted on our website at WPR.org/Food Friday. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. There's a line for you to tell us how you've been using tomatoes this summer. Maybe you have a favorite tomato recipe you'd like to share. Perhaps you grow your own. Do you have a favorite variety or one that seems to be growing particularly well this year? 800-642-1234 is the number to call, or you can email us at ideas@WPR.org. We've got Miriam from Taylor's Falls, Minnesota on the line. Hi, Miriam.
Hello there.
What are you thinking when we're talking about tomatoes?
Well, when I was strapped for time one year, I discovered just the easiest way that preserves incredibly intense tomato flavor. And I've used it with everything from cherry tomatoes to big fat slices, you know. With the cherry tomatoes, I just cut them in half. With the rest of them, I slice them into quarter-inch slices, kind of across, you know, horizontally, and spread them out edge to edge, on a rimmed cookie sheet that's lightly oiled with olive oil. Just totally cover it with those slices. Drizzle it lightly with olive oil and garlic or garlic salt, powdered garlic, however you like, and put them in the oven at about, I think, 375, 400, and roast them until they're just starting to get toasty brown. And then I take them out and put them in the freezer. Put the whole cookie sheet in the freezer until they freeze, and then take the slices off with a cookie spatula and pop them right into freezer boxes, and you have access to those slices of tomatoes all winter.
Miriam, yeah, thank you for describing that for us. I bet your place smells so good when that is happening. That really just sounds delicious. And Deb, is Miriam getting more flavor from those tomatoes because of that little bit of roasting they're doing ahead of time?
Absolutely. When you do roast them, whether you grill them or roast them, you're actually bringing the flavors out. And it just enhances the depth of what tomatoes are all about. And in fact, what she was talking about is absolutely perfect, because you can even take them from whether you freeze them, or you can even put those same tomatoes into olive oil, and you can pack them with some peppercorns or garlic, and you can actually make what we call like sun-dried tomatoes. It doesn't have to be the tomatoes don't have to be, you know, reduced in size via the sun. You can use your oven for that, just as you can with dehydrating them and that. So by doing that, you're actually giving the depth of flavor to it. And then by freezing it, I agree, you can have them, you know, for as what, six to 12 months in your freezer and have them available. But you can also freeze them by just slicing them. And what I like to suggest is putting them on a tray, wrapping plastic around them, you know, but quarter them, you know, and put them in the freezer, let them freeze, and then bag them as quarters. And then that way you can take out, it'll actually cause them to become individualized, and then you can take out however much you want for the season. So that way you can really freeze things quickly and use up your tomatoes if you're really, you know, getting backed up with trying to figure out what to do with them.
And then you would use those frozen tomatoes in things that you'd cook, like sauces or, you know, casseroles or something like that?
Oh, absolutely. You can come up with like over 33 ways of what you can do with them. But you can juice them, which is like a great starter for like Bloody Marys, for example, if you want to do that, or make like a V8 type of juice, a healthy juice. You could juice them. You can make soup, like a tomato, French tomato bisque soup, which is absolutely wonderful, which a lot of folks love to dip like grilled cheese in them. You can make tomato sauces. And one of the simplest ones that I know of is to make it with like onion and a little bit of butter and tomatoes, and you cook it over in a large fry pan and for about 30-40 minutes, and it makes the most amazing rich sauce you've ever had. It's just delicious, and then you kind of garnish with some basil. So yeah, it's, you can make, you can even use it to make salsas and pico de gallo, tomato paste, ketchup, pizza sauce. And that's why I love to freeze it, because it gives you time to be able to, you know, use it in all these different recipes.
Marianne on Facebook says BLTs or pico de gallo, so that's certainly on the list. We are talking with Deb Melian, who's walking us through our options as the tomatoes ripen, or maybe don't, late in the summertime. This is Food Friday here on Central Time, and we're going from Bloody Marys to salsas, everything in between. And Deb, you also have a recipe for cheesy tomato onion tart. Will you take us through that?
Yes. This is a very elegant meal, but it can be used both as a meal and as an appetizer. And basically, what you'll do is, I like to use a Pillsbury, like a refrigerated pie crust type of thing. You'll put it in like a tart pan. And then in a fry pan, large skillet, you're going to add some olive oil, onion, salt, and pepper. And then you're going to cook these onions down until they're nice and softened. And for about 10 minutes. And then what you're going to do is lay these out in the pie, on the pie, across the pie crust, and then add cherry tomatoes. Now you can slice them or you can leave them whole. And then you layer it with cheese. And I like to use like Fontina and Gruyere, because it really gives a little bit of a bite to the cheese and really melts beautifully. And then you'll sprinkle some basil and then put that into the bake for about 25 minutes until the crust is golden brown. And it's easy to slice. You can hold it in the palm of your hand if you want, if you let it come to room temperature, and it's amazingly delicious.
We're talking through a few recipes with Deb Melian. Still just a bit of time for you here on Food Friday. Give us a call at 800-642-1234 to share what you want about tomatoes, whether it's your favorite recipe or how you handle them and preserve them. 800-642-1234. And Deb, you mentioned this from the very beginning, that you can use green tomatoes. They do not have to be that beautiful color of red. So we've got a solution for the end of the season for those tomatoes that don't quite ripen: Wisconsin fried green tomatoes. How do we make them?
Okay. For that, what you're going to do is you'll use like about 4 cups of sliced green tomatoes. And for this recipe, you're going to use flour rather than cornmeal, and you'll use about 1 cup of that. And to that, you're going to add some paprika, garlic powder, cayenne pepper, and mix that all up together. You'll dredge the green tomatoes, kind of pat off any excess flour, and then put it in a pan with some vegetable oil and fry on both sides. It takes about 7 to 10 minutes total. And then you have an appetizer that is just amazing. It just, you know, we talked about bringing out the, you know, roasting it in the oven. But when you cook it like this on in a skillet, it just brings out those flavors. And you wouldn't think, because I was a naysayer, I have to admit, in the beginning. But once I had them, I am just, you know, anywhere I can get them. And I really do look forward to the end of the season when that's all I will have is green tomatoes. And I'll fry these up and my family just loves them.
Yeah, I have to say, I've tried this twice, and once was a fantastic success. And I have no idea what I did the other time. I just destroyed them. They did not work. It was not a pretty sight. Is there any sort of trick or any kind of a tip that we should keep in mind when we're trying out a new recipe like this?
Well, what I like to do is just, I try to follow it, you know, as close as possible. And then I veer from that. But with the green tomatoes, usually they are pretty firm anyways, and they will hold up under the heat. And sometimes cooking them less is best, you know, because sometimes if you overcook them, they might get a little bit gushy, but for the most part, I think, you know, you should be fine with this one. And if you want, you can even, after you get done, you can par cook them and then just put them in the oven and then finish and then bake them, finish with the baking of them and put it like at 350, 375 and then bring them out probably after about 10, 15 minutes and you're all set there too. So you do have some options.
Yeah. And as we wrap up, Deb, you know, you do a lot of canning and preserving. Is there anything in particular we should keep in mind when we're trying to can tomatoes?
Well, the thing about tomatoes is that they're not like regular jams where you can just, you know, forego the boiling and that. You need to go through the whole process. And companies like, you know, Ball jars and stuff like that, you know, and lots of things you can find online where they talk about, like, you know, after you can and leaving, you know, like about a quarter inch from the top, especially if you're canning salsas or tomato sauces and that stuff, and always using fresh tops and lids and stuff like that. And using, you know, the boiling baths or pressure cookers and stuff. That's important to keep the tomatoes, you know, whatever you're making, the sauces or whatever, as healthy as possible. So follow those directions exactly, because, you know, you don't want to, you know, if it doesn't pop, you know, or if it has that little where it makes that noise, put it in the refrigerator and then use it up, you know, within 2 to 3 weeks. Yeah. But for the most part, you should be okay with a lot of the canning methods that are out there.
Follow the directions. I like that, Deb. Thank you so much for that tip, because we don't always do it. And for all of the rest of the conversation here we've had about tomatoes, we appreciate your time.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it, too.
This has been a lot of fun. Deb Melian is an online writer, recipe developer, homemaker, and traveler. Her website, WisconsinHomemaker.com, has her favorite family-friendly recipes, along with helpful seasonal tips for your home and garden. And you can find the recipes for classic caprese salad, cheesy tomato onion tart, and those Wisconsin fried green tomatoes over at WPR.org/Food Friday. Coming up after the news, the coronavirus pandemic has compounded the already difficult housing market in La Crosse. We're checking in with a local reporter for the latest. I'm Keely Boltina. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. Thanks for joining us here on Central Time. I'm Keely Boltina in for Rob Ferret, and this is the Ideas Network. Coming up, Senator Ron Johnson said on a Minnesota radio program that a probe he's pursued into the transition of power between the Obama and Trump administrations would help elect President Trump. We'll talk to a political reporter who's been following this story and more. First, rising costs and stagnant wages have been contributing to a housing crisis in La Crosse. Then this spring, the coronavirus pandemic hit. Our guest has been looking into the challenges La Crosse renters are facing and how the public health emergency could be causing an uptick in housing insecurity. Olivia Herkin is the local government reporter for the La Crosse Tribune. Her recent piece is titled La Crosse Already Had a Housing Crisis, but COVID-19 worsened it. Olivia, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Let's start from the beginning then. What did the housing situation look like in La Crosse before this pandemic began?
Yeah, I mean, La Crosse, like many cities, has had a problem with affordable housing for quite some time now. Rent in the city keeps rising, though paychecks are staying the same for many residents or even getting smaller for some now. And oftentimes people are settling for homes that they can afford, but they're just unlivable. In fact, in the last report from the city, 1 in 5 households in La Crosse experienced a severe housing problem. So the city was already in a bad spot before the pandemic came in and really made matters worse.
So 20% of the people who live in La Crosse have experienced a housing problem.
1 in 5 experience a severe housing problem, severe. But 37% experience some type of housing problem.
Wow. So it's even more. And tell us more then about how those rising costs conflict with a standard of living for renters there.
Yeah. For one, you know, the costs are really rising because La Crosse is a big college town. So it places the floor on rent, meaning off-campus student housing is expensive. So it makes the market more competitive and drives up the rent for more surrounding homes. But another thing more directly specific to La Crosse is a property assessment that was done last year for all homes. It's really driven up property taxes for so many homeowners. And so in turn, that makes rent for their tenants go up as well.
And they're not necessarily getting any better quality living space for it. It's just more expensive.
Correct. Yeah. And, you know, and the wages are really staying stagnant as well. So people can't get out of these situations. You know, they're stuck in the places that they can afford.
Sure. It's not like you can just spend more money someplace to get a different place because you don't have more money to spend. Exactly. You spoke with some renters who experienced just that, and they're living in less than ideal living conditions. Tell us about one of them.
Yeah, I spoke with the Dare family. They moved to La Crosse just 2 years ago from Portland, Oregon, into a home they found on Craigslist. They moved in sight unseen. And believe it or not, at the time, they moved to La Crosse because the housing was much more affordable than that in Portland, which it is. But once they moved in, the quality of the home just really unraveled. They began finding nails in their backyard. The home was missing its garage. There were holes in the walls, exposed wires, and ceilings weren't up to code. And all the while, their property manager is really unresponsive, sometimes taking weeks to respond or even over a year to make some of these repairs. And so the most recent battle that they face is over their oven. It's been broken for more than 100 days, and their property manager has refused to fix it because it's a cosmetic repair.
So they have just been in a situation where they don't have, you know, appropriate kitchen equipment to cook with, but they can't replace it and it's not their home. And yet the owner doesn't.
Right. Exactly. And so now this family is really stuck. They are stuck with kind of a negligent property manager. And they're really afraid of what the pandemic is going to do to their jobs. The dad is a campus minister and their mom is a teaching aide in the school district. So they're really uneasy about taking on a mortgage right now or a more expensive rental. And they just re-signed their lease because of that. And then shortly after found out that the homeowner was trying to sell the home, which means that they could be uprooted with, you know, as little as a month's notice in the middle of a pandemic, no less.
And the homes that are available, then it sounds like they can't afford.
Correct. Yeah. Housing is really disproportionate. The places that people can afford are usually mixed in with student housing. And so as a family with three little children, you know, they may not want to live next to college students who live a very different life than them.
Yeah. Olivia Herkin is the local government reporter for the La Crosse Tribune, and we're talking about her reporting into rental housing in that part of Wisconsin, and she's written a new piece about it that highlights different homeowners. Olivia, Wisconsin had a moratorium on evictions this spring. What happened in La Crosse when management was able to evict homeowners again?
Yeah, I really found the numbers on evictions after that really interesting. When the state eviction moratorium was first lifted at the end of May, landlords did begin trying to evict tenants at higher rates in La Crosse, which was expected. In La Crosse specifically, 51 evictions were filed for the month of June alone, compared to 30 that were filed in June of last year. But what is really surprising to me is that since then, eviction rates have actually balanced back out for the moment. And officials think that's really due to the government relief people are receiving, whether that's in the shape of rental assistance or their stimulus checks are finally coming through or even the boost in unemployment that people got.
And yet those programs are temporary. So how are leaders talking about how to try to handle this this problem when these programs are set to run out?
Right. Of course, that is really the caveat that this help, like the Wisconsin Rental Assistance Program, is in jeopardy right now until more funding is approved at the federal level. And those that are working in the relief are anxious that the help that they're providing will just suddenly have to stop and more people will be forced out of their homes. So I just think that's a testament that this funding, this relief was working and helping people and really making a difference. And if it's not renewed, a real crisis is going to be made even worse for some people.
Another one of the renters that you talked to didn't want to use her name because she was afraid. Well, what was she afraid of? She was afraid of retaliation.
Right. She had been living in a really negligent apartment for, I'm not sure how long, but she had found some mice in her apartment, and her landlords were really, really nasty to her for it. And so she's stuck in some legal battles right now with them. So she was afraid to use her name.
And that went so far as that they accused her of planting the mice. Like, it correct. I mean, yeah. these relationships can really degrade quickly, and it's the place you live.
Right, exactly. Yeah, they threatened to come into her apartment late at night without her permission. They were shoveling the snow onto her sidewalk. They threatened to take her parking spot away. So, right, like, people are just becoming very stuck in the places that they live in. And she was particularly stuck because she was a cab driver. You know, she only made $9 an hour, so there was only so much that she could afford. And if people are on a year-long lease, if they want to move from a place they're living, they have to break that lease. That oftentimes means paying the rent until they can find a new leaser.
Yeah. So what are you watching as you pay attention to what happens in the La Crosse housing market that affects so many renters in your area?
I think the biggest thing will be just to see what the federal government can approve in funding and how that will trickle down to help the states and the local municipalities like La Crosse.
Yeah. All right. We'll pay attention to what you write in the future, Olivia. Thank you so much for your time and explaining your reporting.
Thanks for having me.
Olivia Herkin is the local government reporter for the La Crosse Tribune. She's been covering the increase in housing insecurity during the coronavirus pandemic, and she was with us to talk through what she's been seeing and what she's hearing from people who are renting homes in the La Crosse area. Coming up, we're talking to a political reporter about a probe Wisconsin Senator Johnson has pursued and why Ron Johnson says it could help re-elect President Trump in November. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Keeley Boltina. Coming up, there have been many cases of people wrongfully convicted for crimes that others committed. We're talking with a former public defender about a different kind of wrongful conviction, one in which there was actually no crime in the first place. That's ahead here on Central Time. Now, Wisconsin U.S. Senator Ron Johnson has continued his pursuit of an investigation into alleged corruption within governmental agencies during the transition of power between the Obama and Trump administrations. Johnson, a Republican, is the chairman of the Senate Homeland Security and Government Affairs Committee, and he's been requesting documents and other information from groups such as the FBI and the CIA for the last couple of years. However, his recent comments have Democrats crying foul over these investigations, namely that Johnson is weaponizing his position to disrupt the candidacy of presumptive Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden. Kyle Chaney is a congressional reporter for Politico. Kyle, welcome back to Central Time.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Let's take a step back. As someone who covers Congress, what is Senator Ron Johnson's standing among lawmakers in the Senate?
So, I mean, look, he is the chairman of the Homeland Security and Government Affairs Committee. It's a very powerful panel that has just charged with general oversight of government. So he has a wide-ranging authority to conduct investigations as he sees fit. And, you know, he's one of 53 Republicans. He's got, you know, and every Republican senator has a lot of power. Depending on what committee they chair, even a little bit disproportionately more than others. He wields some influence in the caucus there.
And what are Senator Johnson and some other Republican leaders saying they think happened when it comes to corruption allegations against the FBI, for example?
So it's a broad range of allegations. I mean, the Senate Judiciary Committee that Lindsey Graham chairs is investigating the origins of the Russia investigation against President Donald Trump and his campaign. And Ron Johnson's committee is actually looking at a very similar set of allegations, except he's looking more specifically at what may have happened after the election, but before Trump took office, so the transition period. And so that's the difference between what he's doing and what Senator Graham is doing. And Ron Johnson is also looking at allegations that again, Democrats believe are full of disinformation, but allegations that Vice President Biden used his position to corruptly get a prosecutor in Ukraine fired in order to protect his son from an investigation in Ukraine. So he's looking at both of those issues and kind of linking them together in certain ways.
Why have these concerns persisted for lawmakers like Senator Johnson over the last several years?
Well, if you ask Democrats, it's politics. They say that these charges against Biden in particular have been completely debunked and under oath by a lot of witnesses during impeachment, during other investigations and fact checkers and all that. And then the claims against the Russia investigation, the FBI, stem from, in large part, President Donald Trump's allegations that his campaign was improperly spied on, that his administration, his incoming administration, was improperly treated by the outgoing Obama administration. These are politically explosive allegations. These are things that, if you ask Democrats and if you ask a lot of, national security experts, are things that are overblown and exaggerated or based on people with political motivations leveling some of these charges. But Republicans listened to the president's complaints. They found certain evidence of improprieties in the FBI, and they're zooming in on those.
Well, we are fully in the politics territory now. Senator Johnson was a guest on a Minneapolis-based radio program hosted by John Justice and Drew Lee on Tuesday. And part of their conversation was about the investigations that he's pursued and took issue especially with the number of classified documents in agencies like the FBI and his lack of access to the documents. Let's take a listen.
He may just have people that are protecting the reputation of the agency. He might have people protecting themselves. And you also might have just political hacks in these agencies so that would just as soon see Donald Trump defeated and former Vice President Joe Biden elected. And that may be part of this, too. I mean, the more that we expose of the corruption of the transition process between Obama and Trump, the more we expose of the corruption within those agencies, I would think would certainly help Donald Trump win re-election and certainly be pretty good. I would say evidence about not voting for Vice President Biden.
Yeah, Kyle, what have you seen as a reaction to a U.S. senator saying that as far as his colleagues on Capitol Hill?
Well, so the last part of that is what was so explosive. I mean, Democrats have been saying for a long time, this investigation that Ron Johnson is running is political. It's aimed at damaging Joe Biden on these trumped up charges of corruption, a wide range of allegations against him that they say are exaggerations or outright falsehoods. When he says this is going to help Donald Trump win re-election, that confirms Democrats' worst fears, and it reminds them of what Majority Leader Kevin McCarthy, Republican House Leader Kevin McCarthy said about the Benghazi investigation into Hillary Clinton, that it was working because it had lowered her poll numbers. And that at the time engendered a huge backlash. And so I think we're seeing some of that now, that people say, look, how can you say this isn't political if you're putting it in terms of whether it's going to help Donald Trump get reelection or hurt Joe Biden?
Democrats, as expected, responded that way. Is Johnson in hot water with any of his fellow Republicans?
Now, it's still playing out, but we know that some Republicans on his own committee, including senators like Mitt Romney, have raised concerns about how political the investigation looks. So now Romney did ultimately support some of the investigative steps that Johnson took, but has said, I don't want this to become a political circus, and said he only agreed to support some of these steps because Johnson promised to do a lot of things behind closed doors, avoiding sort of the spectacle that could have come if he tried to do public hearings with some politically powerful players on the Democratic side. Whether they'll speak out now, given his political framing of the investigation, we haven't seen that yet. It's still pretty early. But if he starts issuing subpoenas and escalating the efforts to get some of Biden's allies in front of his committee, we may see more of that.
We're talking with Kyle Chaney, who's a congressional reporter for Politico, about U.S. Senator Ron Johnson and the investigations that he's running as he is looking into work through his chairmanship of the Senate Homeland Security and Government Affairs Committee. You're listening to Central Time. And I know we went there politically, and if we can take that out of the mix, do we have an objective sense as to how legitimate these allegations are or how seriously lawmakers are really taking them?
So look, the claims against Biden in particular that he helped engineer the removal of a Ukrainian prosecutor, actually withheld a loan guarantee from Ukraine to get a prosecutor removed in order to protect his son, that's the version of the allegations that Republicans are so attuned to. Now, Biden was running U.S. policy in Ukraine, and the State Department viewed this Ukrainian prosecutor as a corrupt actor and wanted him gone to help increase the transparency and trust in the Ukrainian government. And I think that's what the pushback is there's no way Joe Biden was trying to get rid of this prosecutor for corrupt reasons. This prosecutor himself was corrupt and actually inhibiting corruption investigations in Ukraine. So it's a bit convoluted, but you know, the substance of the investigation has been called into question and in some cases debunked by the people who were running the State Department at the time.
We have a caller on the line who's ready to talk with us, wants to weigh in on this conversation. Dennis from Two Rivers. Hi there.
Hi. At this late time for this investigation, Ron Johnson could just kind of stretch this whole thing out and try to smudge Joe Biden without really coming up with anything. So if after the election is over, they could just say, well, we really didn't find anything, or just drop it completely if Trump would be reelected. So it's not really something that necessarily hurts Joe Biden, but at least casts a suspicion.
Yeah, Dennis, thanks for that point. So, you know, Kyle, hearing Dennis there say it doesn't really matter what they find, the suspicion's out there now.
Right, and to a lot of Democrats, they say, look, that's the point of what he's doing. Now, Ron Johnson said he's going to issue a report in September or so. So that may be the, you know, again, Democrats find the timing suspicious, too, given the election being so close by that point. But they see it more as just keep the allegations in the air, not necessarily need to find, you know, a smoking gun conclusion of any kind. But we'll see what the report ultimately shows.
Right, because Senator Johnson has taken steps over these last few years to get the investigations going. He's done real governmental movements.
He has, he'll be the first to say that. I've been looking at these for years. It wasn't when Joe Biden necessarily was a candidate or certainly wasn't the leading candidate when he took some of these steps. But, you know, Democrats say it's too coincidental that it's just sort of reaching its conclusion and climax right as we get to the home stretch of the election.
Yeah. We are talking with Kyle Chaney about U.S. Senator Ron Johnson and the decisions that he's making in leadership on Capitol Hill. And I want to switch gears just a little bit, but it still involves Senator Johnson. We are months into the COVID-19 pandemic. This is related to the economic fallout. The talks over the HEROES Act have really broken down among senators. I mean, they've left Washington for their August recess for the most part. And Senator Johnson spoke to Breitbart Radio last week following the stalled negotiations. And here's what he said about it.
From my standpoint, the breakdown of the talks is very good news. It's very good news for future generations. We're already $26.5 trillion in debt on our way to $27 or $28 trillion. We don't have an unlimited checking account. So I'm glad there's not a deal. I'm glad President Trump will hopefully fill in the holes and provide relief where it's actually needed, direct it. So to me, this is good news. I hope the talks remain broken down. I hope Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer don't become reasonable, because their definition of reasonable is not mine.
Kyle, are other Republican lawmakers making the same argument here? The breakdown of the relief talks is good.
Not as overtly as that. Now, we've heard from, I think Lindsey Graham said out loud the other day that about 20 of his colleagues are probably in that same boat. They're not going to support anything. But the majority of Republicans in both the House and Senate do want some kind of a package, especially those who are vulnerable in terms of their reelections. They know that a slowdown in the economy because the money stops flowing could be bad for everyone. And so I think the majority of both chambers want something done. And the president wants a deal, too. He's been out there today saying we got to pass something to get more money in people's pockets during this difficult time. So I think Ron Johnson, he's not alone, but he's in the minority on that view.
And how do we need to think about his comment, though, in relation to the other things that he's saying in the last bit? I mean, is this a senator who's being more political, I guess, than other people?
Well, it may be his genuinely held view that more government spending, that adding another multi-trillion dollar bill, to the balance sheet of the government is not a good thing. I mean, I think that has been sort of a consistent position for him. But, it's again, we're less than 100 days from the election. I think we're still in the middle of a pandemic and an economic crisis across the country. So I don't think he's going to, find a lot of colleagues sharing that opinion at this point.
Yeah, absolutely. Kyle, thank you so much for your analysis.
Great to be here. Thanks so much.
Kyle Chaney is a congressional reporter for Politico, and he joined us today to talk about a probe Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson continues to pursue into alleged misdeeds in the Obama-Trump transition. In serious, but also kind of funny news, we are here to remind you to leave wild animals well enough alone. A motorcycle rider weaving through Custer State Park in South Dakota stopped along the road as a bison herd ambled around it. And instead of keeping a safe distance from these massive creatures with giant horns, she walked closer and closer and then too close. An adult bison charged when she got near a calf, and it caught her belt on its horns. So the bison thrashed, and the woman slammed to the ground, and then the bison ran away with the woman's pants. Embarrassing, for sure, and also very lucky. The woman went to the hospital and thankfully was not seriously hurt. So this right here is your friendly public service announcement that the picture is not worth the risk. Better to invest in a good zoom lens for your camera. I'm Keeley Boltina. You're listening to Central Time, and this is the Ideas Network.